Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello. Welcome to the Mobilities and Methods series. This series is hosted by the New Books Network in association with the Mobilities and Methods Lab at the University of Illinois at Chicago. The Mobilities and Methods Lab and New Books Network partnership provides a platform for authors, readers, and their interlocutors to engage closely with questions of mobility and movement. My name is Aliza Ercan. Today, I'm joined by Ahmet Kanna, Amelie Lehrenmart, and Neha Vora. Ahmet Kanna is Associate Professor of Anthropology at the University of the Pacific. Amelie Lehrenmart is sociologist and researcher at the Centre National de la Recherche Scientifique. And Neha Vora is Associate Professor of Sociology and Anthropology at Lafayette College. We'll be talking about their book, Beyond Exception, New Interpretations of the Arabian Peninsula, published recently by Cornell University Press. Thank you very much, Ahmet, Amelie, and Neha, for joining us today. So to start off, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and your collaboration that led to this book?
Sure, I can take that one. So what started the whole kernel that started the book was Ahmet and I were on a panel at a conference where we were both presenting on different aspects of our research. And in those research presentations, some of the things that came up were the forms of white privilege that circulate in the Gulf and what it meant for us personally in terms of our subject position to do the research. And we got a lot of pushback from certain members of the audience, especially white Americans who had lived in the Gulf. So we started talking about this, and we started talking about what it means to be people of color in American academia, and also what it means to be doing research in the Gulf from our different perspectives. So that led to a conference paper that is on doing fieldwork in the Gulf, and we used that conference paper to reflect on our early fieldwork experiences. So that is what you'll see in the second chapter of this book. And then we wanted to bring somebody else on too to kind of round out the conversation. And because Amelie's work is such a great fit, we reached out to Amelie, and then the three of us started having a conversation. And that is what led to the structure of the book the way that it is now.
That's wonderful to hear. And I love that you use whiteness as an analytic in the book throughout, which is something that we don't see often, especially in, you know, studies that address the particular region. And, you know, my next question sort of builds on that. I was wondering what is specifically at stake in thinking through whiteness and thinking through the Gulf exceptionalism. And how did you approach the project of de-exceptionalizing the Arabian Peninsula in the book?
Okay, hello, this is Ahmet Kanna. So I'll take on this one. To address the question of Gulf exceptionalism more broadly, basically our approach was twofold. We looked very carefully through the critique of categories such as whiteness, but also I would argue colonialism, imperialism, class, and other sort of modes of power. We use those lenses to basically review our, especially our early forays into the region, our early sort of graduate research, and our first early career engagements with the region. So we did a, I guess the term for this in anthropology is reflexivity. We drew on the literature and the approach of reflexivity in anthropology and in sociology to look critically at how often unconscious structures of feeling, power, racialization, and colonialism still inform the methodology and the literature that are made about, in particular, the Gulf. And I think, speaking for myself, but I think also for Amelie and Neha probably could echo this, we found that there was a sort of the Gulf. It was easy for scholars to make superficial and highly sort of orientalizing claims about the Gulf, even many years or even decades after such approaches were rejected in other post-colonial regions. So that was our first approach. Our second approach was basically to look at and to sort of support and foreground other research being done on the region by scholars who we think also shared our de-exceptionalizing critical approach. So our first, our introductory chapter really tries to cite carefully as much of this research as possible. So I'll stop there for now.
That's wonderful to know. And, you know, I want to dig a little bit into the question of knowledge production, especially in ethnography, which I think your book does a great job at addressing. And, you know, as part of developing a critique of ethnography, you take up the arrival trope in ethnographic writing, especially in accounts of the Gulf. And I was wondering if you could tell our listeners how you think through this trope, both collectively and in your individual works.
So I think that's also to me, or we sort of divided up the questions, and I think I'll take this one on. But I think also Emily and Neha, if you guys want to chime in, obviously feel free to do that. So I mean, I think arrival is this classic sort of this literary device in ethnographic writing that was sort of reproduced uncritically for a long time until about the 90s when there was this new sort of turn towards looking at ethnographic writing as a genre of writing and how it is structured, how is it organized, and how does it contribute to the construction of its object of study? So for me, the trope of arrival or thinking about arrival critically goes beyond, and in fact is not even at all about literal arriving in a place, but it's rather about how a certain literary category or conceit constructs an object of analysis. And what I mean more concretely by that is that there's this older idea that, you know, you go from your quote unquote home culture, your native culture, quote unquote, to this other culture. And that once you sort of arrive in that place, you are confronted with otherness and cultural difference and these sort of very simplistic binary ideas of cultural difference. And we drew a lot on the critique of this work that was happening, I think around the time when we were training in graduate school and after, to try to emphasize as much as possible that this trope of arrival and other similar ideas of otherness tend to erase I mean, they very much do erase interconnectedness and the ways in which even the Gulf as a region is a construction that to which imperial logics and neoliberalism and capitalism have contributed a lot. And so I think, you know, for me, this idea of arrival really sort of reifies and fabricates ideas of difference where we really should be talking about interconnection. And I think that that's actually very much connected to the idea of de-exceptionalization that we're trying to argue for.
Absolutely. And I was wondering if you could individually tell us a little bit about how, you know, this critique emerged from your own experiences as you conducted fieldwork.
I can start on that. I think that, you know, this was part of the conversations that we had very early on when we were planning the book. For me, I was coming in wanting to do, you know, having read all of the South Asian diaspora literature that I could get my hands on and wanting to do a classic like diasporic ethnographic study. And, you know, I expected to find, you know, even though it's so odd to me now to think about it, all of the things that I read about the Gulf focused on Khalijis and on Khaliji culture. And when immigrants were mentioned, they were only mentioned in passing, and they were always mentioned as outsiders. But I knew from having my own family networks and growing up in an Indian diaspora community that there are lots of people who live in a place like Dubai. So I thought I was going to find, for my first visit in Dubai, I thought it was like, oh, you're going to land in Dubai and then you're going to have to go find the Little India, right? And if anyone who's been to Dubai, there is no Little India. The whole thing is Little India, right? Like that's basically one of the arguments in my first book. I had to kind of undo a lot of the presumptions of who belongs and who naturally belongs to a place like Dubai in order to actually get to the arguments and even get to the actual research before I even got to the arguments, right? So it's kind of one of the things that we're looking at is how the literature that we read before we go to the field, the kinds of categories and vocabularies that we naturalize, how those in fact can impede us from seeing what's there.
Amélie, would you like to go next?
Yeah, thank you. Hi. Yes, for me, I think it was also a gradual process because, so for me, it was a gradual process because I was really trained as a specialist of like the Arab world, and my master's program was actually called like Muslim world. So, and so I've studied Arabic and so on. So I think I was, when I began my PhD, I was really in the typical imagination of what fieldwork is and how it's different from my home society and so on. So that was my point of departure. And so my PhD was about gender and the lifestyles of young women in Saudi Arabia, in Riyadh. So I don't think it was a very exceptionalist framework since I decided not to, you know, focus on like oppression or like the very typical questions that people want to talk about when you talk about women in Saudi Arabia, such as, I don't know, polygyny, veil and so on. But at the same time, in the end, I realized that some aspects were problematic, such as like the fact of like focusing only on Saudi women and not taking into account non-Saudi women, for instance, while like one third of Riyadh's population is non-Saudi. So it was the first like self-criticism. And afterwards, I think it came from also the ways in which my work was interpreted in France and the ways in which I realized like the what's at stake also when you talk about the Gulf in other contexts and how like whatever you say, you always get the same questions and comments. And so it was also like, I was like, okay, what's do I really want to do that now? So that was kind of the question. And then, yes, so then I decided also to work on like Western passport holders. It was also a reaction to the people I met when I was doing my fieldwork actually in Riyadh, like the discourses they had, the statues they had, the lifestyles they had, the gender norms they embodied and the whiteness they embodied and so on. So it was also like from the fieldwork that I wanted to focus on this, and then I decided to change and to work on Dubai. But basically that was the process.
That's wonderful. How about you, Ahmed?
Yeah, no, these are really, I echo everything that Neha and Amelie said. I mean, and to add my own perspective to that, it's so difficult to begin to try to disentangle the problematic assumptions that I brought to the field initially that I had inherited from the literature, or the dominant sort of trends in the literature. I don't want to imply that all the literature was bad, not at all, or that it was all problematic. A lot of it was quite good. But I guess for me, there's a couple of notes I would make. One is that, you know, my own background is Iraqi, and I grew up partly in the Gulf. We lived in Kuwait when I was young to just before adolescence. And at that time, we moved to the United States. So being from Iraq and of an Iraqi family, and there is a big Iraqi community in the Gulf as well, in the Emirates and in Kuwait until the Gulf War. That's a pretty distinct community. During my fieldwork, I was interacting a lot with Iraqis, and there is this complicated relationship that Iraqis have to the Gulf. Part of it is, you know, the idea that Iraq is like this ancient civilization. It's Mesopotamia. It's you know, cultured and so on and so on and so on. And one of the sort of binaries that Iraqis sometimes often make, is to the Gulf, actually. Like the Khalijis, you know, they're seen as less cultured and so on. Nouveau riche, you know. So there was that angle. That was definitely happening way before I went to grad school and studied the region. The other part of it was very similar to what Neha and Amelie were talking about, the kinds of the literature. What it left out was a lot of the complexity of the region, but also what it tended to reinforce was that there was this kind of binary or like sort of.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Distinctions between Gulf nationals and non-nationals, especially people from South Asia or Iran or other parts of the global South, that these hard distinctions that were sort of always reproduced every day and sort of indexed through the national dress and so on. And, you know, what you find is actually people are borrowing culturally from each other all the time. And, you know, Emirati food is largely Indian food, you know, and East African food, for example. So I mean, that's just one small example. I could cite many, many others. I also became very interested in the, you know, politics of imperialism and capitalism. And I think without understanding, without de-exceptionalizing the Gulf, you really can't understand modern capitalism or finance capital, or even, you know, the idea that the United States, for example, being an oil state. You know, we talk about the Gulf as being oil states, but we don't talk about the U.S. as being an oil state. Why don't we do that? And so on. I could go on, but I'll stop there.
Yeah, this is very productive to think with, because one main thing that you do throughout the book is to locate the Gulf within global processes, but also, you know, you do commercially locate global processes within the Gulf. And, you know, as I read the book, it came across to me as a methodology of sorts for de-exceptionalizing the region. So what does connection making do epistemologically for you, both, you know, as an overarching theoretical framework, but also in your individual works?
So, yeah, this is Neha. Amelie was referring before to the same questions come up from lay people and also from fellow academics when they hear that you're doing the Gulf. And they will have read your piece, which is challenging an exceptionalizing framework. And yet the questions that I get are, can you drive in Qatar? Do you have to wear a headscarf? What about all of the slave labor? And it just, it gets so redundant that these Orientalist stereotypes to talk about Khalijis, and then this idea that my immigrants are all exploited, hyper-exploited, and completely without agency. And Ahmed talks about this in terms of how it erases worker protests that happen quite often in the Gulf. And at the time when those questions first started coming to me was when I was finishing up my dissertation and I was living in Southern California. I found it so ironic that I could get questions about slave labor in the Gulf when I'm looking at the people who are tending the gardens on the university campus, right? And all of the ways that Southern California relies upon hyper-exploited Mexican labor, right? And so from the very beginning, I would kind of push back by giving an example here. We can't really talk about the kafala system. If we're talking about the kafala system, why aren't we talking about the H-1B system, right? But that framework of just like giving a, but look over here, is not, I think, as effective as what we started to develop, I think, individually and in conversation, which is, it's not that this is happening over here and similar thing is happening over there. It's that these are actually part of larger global processes in terms of how immigration has been redefined to be, you know, crudely about labor and about how governments are shifting their laws so that there's less opportunities for naturalization. The kinds of xenophobic rhetoric we've seen clearly in the last few years how right-wing rhetoric around the world is building on each other, right? How they're bouncing off of each other. So that kind of brought me more to looking at, you can't look at a diasporic population in one part of the world, especially Indian diasporas, because there's such a long history of these middlemen networks that are transnational. You can't really look at one place without looking at the connections around the world and how Indian labor is kind of constructed and the streams of Indian labor and where people go and how they are trained to go there and how their own co-ethnics are bringing them there and profiting off of them. And so that's kind of where I got to in terms of my own work and thinking about connections as a way to de-exceptionalize.
Neha, I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about these connections in higher education. I'm very glad you brought up the university. And in the book, you talk about these connections to think about the American university as an archive. So I was wondering if you could tell our listeners a bit about that.
Sure. So in my more recent book, Teach for Arabia, I'm looking at American branch campuses in Qatar. And, you know, what pushed me into the book project itself was actually the fact that a lot of the kids, the second generation children of Indian immigrants in Dubai, had started going to these branch campuses because they were proliferating in the UAE. They started proliferating in the UAE in the early to mid 2000s. So originally I wanted to know, is this a way of cementing belonging even further? Because before they would have to leave to go to college, either in their home country or in a third destination. At the same time, the kinds of conversations that were being had in the U.S. academia, I had just been hired at Texas A&M University in Texas, which has a branch campus in Qatar. It was just kismet that worked out. But all of those questions were about the very same kinds of tropes that we've just talked about. Well, what does it mean to go to this authoritarian place and where, you know, you can't be gay and women are oppressed and there's no freedom of speech? Like, how are we going to have a branch campus there? And this is not to diminish that, like, some of those things are issues, right? But what it is to point out the kinds of mythologies that constructs about what the American university in the United States is, which is supposedly a place free of sexism, homophobia. I lived in Texas at the time, so I found it very funny because you couldn't marry as a same-sex person in Texas either. So I don't really like. I was astonished to see these kinds of critiques coming out of, like, you know, the top-notch famous people in, like, Ivy League colleges and stuff like that. So part of that project was to utilize that discourse to not just point a lens at, like, what's happening in the branch campuses and how that gets occluded if we're only looking at it as, oh, this is blanket illiberalism, right? Or blanket neoliberalism. But also to kind of show how these performances of what I call, like, liberal piety, right? How those also keep us from seeing the very illiberal things that historically and today constitute what we consider the American university.
And I love how Amelie and Ahmed's work speak to each other, taking up, you know, different sides of labor in Dubai, or Dubai and Riyadh in Amelie's case. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that.
Also, to come back on the connection aspect, because I think, in fact, I was really inspired by the now, like, classical text Writing Against Culture by Laila Aboulourad, and in it, like, she talks about connections as a way to write against culture. And so for me, I think it was one of the reasons why I wanted to work on a multinational after my PhD. So I did a field work in a multinational bank in Riyadh, working on the nationalization of jobs. And so I interviewed many people, but actually what I really kept in the final articles about it was especially how a man talked about the hiring women and why we hire Saudi women and so on, because Saudi women are hired in the name of, like, the nationalization of jobs and what kind of stereotypes they had on Saudi women and on Saudi men and so on. And so I was comparing the discourses by especially French and European managers in the bank, and also the discourses by Saudi managers, male managers, I mean, about Saudi women. So it was a first way to study connections. And it was I was very interested in studying how exceptionalist discourses, especially the European managers' exceptionalist discourses, have influence, actually, who can work and who can make a career in the bank and so on, and how, for instance, they they promote a specific form of femininity in the bank, like women that are unveiled and so on, and that are very comfortable to work with men and so on. And how they talk about, you know, so-called westernized women. And it's like, it's as if it was like a skill to be westernized for women. And so it's a discourse that really, I think merits a reflection, like this kind of exceptionalist discourse and the influence it has. So I think it's also one point we wanted to highlight in the book. It's not only about, you know, studying stereotypes and the production of discourses and so on, but we also wanted to shed light on the influence of these discourses and how we can study them in the field. Like, it's not only the academic production or the media production on the Gulf that is exceptionalist. It's actually also some, like, many inhabitants of the Gulf who have, like, exceptionalist representations of their own society and so on. And so we wanted also to study this. And, like, of course, like, when you study Western residents in the Gulf, it's something very strong, actually. So it was very strong in Riyadh, and I could study the influence of this discourse in the bank. And it was also very strong in Dubai. But the Western passport holders in Dubai are a bit different from those who live in Riyadh. And I think it's more diverse. And so I also met people that had more critical discourses on exceptionalism, actually, and especially, like, people, for instance, people who came, like, who had been discriminated against in France and who in the Gulf felt that they were more respected and recognized than like in France. So they were more like, you know, comparing between the two systems rather than saying, like, okay, Dubai is awful and France is the model. And this was also something very much related with whiteness, because white upper-class expatriates tended to have much more exceptionalist representations than people from, like, working class or racialized background in France. So I think exceptionalism also depends on, like, your social position. And, the belief in, like, democracy and justice in Western societies also depends, of course, like, on your position, like, whether you really benefit from it or not.
Ahmed, did you want to chime in?
Yes, and I apologize if I got cut out. My internet is kind of weak here. So, I think both comments by Neha and Emily were really great. Just to echo part of what Emily was just saying, part of what Emily, I think, is saying, at least it's resonating with my own thinking, is how we're not just trying to do an analysis of stereotypes or representations and Orientalism, quote unquote, which personally to me is not interesting at all. But what I liked about what Emily said is that these actually have a material impact in the world. They are deployed in projects of reproducing power or challenging power and constituting class and status and so on. And I think that in particular, you know, where I sort of approach the question of exceptionalism and its critique is in relation to, you know, class struggles in the region. I think, you know, if you look at, for example, the question of labor, as Neha put it really well, when you look at when Western, especially like people coming from a liberal Western perspective, who themselves tend to be quite well-to-do in the U.S. or in Europe, talking about slave labor in the Gulf and talking about the Gulf as if it's like this, well, this exceptional zone where it's apparently to many Westerners, the Gulf is the only place where there's major labor exploitation and racial based on sort of racial or ethnic distinctions, what Cedric Robinson called racial capitalism, right? And I think what actually looking at the Gulf from a de-exceptionalizing framework makes you realize that these processes are pretty damn similar in the U.S., or if not exactly the same, they're based in the same sort of material logics of you know, basically making certain people do the terrible, I don't want to use curse words here, but, you know, do the basic sort of shit work of society. That is not happening only in the Gulf. That's happening everywhere. And in particular, in this moment where I think you see, since the neoliberal period, the use of racial distinctions and ethnic distinctions and gendered distinctions as a way of distributing vulnerability and harm and privilege in society and as a way of distributing sort of desirable and less desirable forms of labor becomes much more intensified, because there is, whether you talk about Western so-called democracies or bourgeois democracies more accurately, or you talk about regimes which are, you know, admittedly authoritarian regimes in the Gulf, there is no pole politically that defends the rights of workers, the rights of vulnerable communities anymore. That collapsed at the end of the Cold War. And I think that if you look at the history of the Gulf, you see the same thing. There were movements of the left, you know, there were movements of that were workers' movements, and even socialist and communist movements in the region. And at least movements for self-determination, whether politically of the left or the center-left, they were destroyed. And partly, mainly because Western colonial powers were supporting local reactionary political movements to do that. That's a very similar process to what's happening in the, you know, the so-called liberal West. By the way, there's echoes, and I think they're similar, not accidentally, but they're similar because they're part of the same project. You know, the project of securing the sort of imperial interests of the U.S. and Britain, in particular, in the region throughout the 20th century. So that was a very sort of broad-ranging comment, and I hope it was concrete and clear. Thanks.
Absolutely. And, you know, I love that you, all of you, have brought out the fact that the exceptionalizing knowledge in the Gulf is not just something that's about, you know, area studies or regional studies, but it sheds light on different parts of the world as well. And I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit on the, you know, decolonial project that comes with this task.
It's very ambitious also to say that we want to decolonize knowledge about the Gulf. So it's more like if I look at how Gulf studies were in the 90s and what existed, like what books existed when I began my PhD. So it was in 2005. I'm like, okay, we like, people have worked, you know, like there has been many shifts in the field. And I think like in the 90s and beginning of years 2000, it was really focused on like oil and political Islam. And it was really like the focus when we talk about the Gulf very much, or about like traditions, tribes and so on. But at the same time, like decolonizing, for instance, would mean that that we take into account much more that like the production on the Gulf by people who actually live in the Gulf. And it's like, I think it's a difficult question because like social science in the Gulf is not necessarily very much visible, like the books that are produced in the Gulf and the works, like very often they never become books. They are actually like, you know, dissertations and so on. And I think that it would be something we would really need to do, like to think about this, like this politics of like knowledge and what works we take into account. So we also tried to suggest like that there are many works that, and sometimes it's not social science. It's also like novels and other cultural productions that actually are very valuable to questioning exceptionalist representations, and that also talk about subjects that are sometimes almost non-existing in research, like such as like the legacy of slavery, of African slavery in the Gulf, or sexuality issues, migration issues, etc. So we should also maybe like broaden our scope of like works that we take into account, I think. But I'm sure that Ahmed and Nea will have other ideas about this.
And I wanted to go back to a point that all of you made, which seems to be in the genesis of your work, which is that, you know, your ambition to take on this project comes from not only your fieldwork or writing, but also from the reactions you've gotten in academic spaces like conferences and workshops. And could you tell us a little bit more about how these academic spaces contribute to Gulf exceptionalism?
I can begin. So I think there is a term that you had underlined in your written questions that was the structural misunderstandings. And it's I think it was present in the first version of the paper by Nea and Ahmed. And I think it's a very interesting term because it's something that I felt when I was talking about my research, like how people misunderstood what I said and how whatever I said, it was very difficult like to convince the people that I'm not, you know, like, for instance, I'm not saying that there is no exploitation in the Gulf, but I'm just saying that we don't necessarily need exceptionalist terms to talk about it, and we can look at various aspects, and there are also, like, middle classes from other countries than from the West and Gulf nationals and so on. So I thought it was very interesting to talk about these misunderstandings as structural because they really say something about what's like the representations that people need to have about the Gulf actually. And so about the academic milieu about the Gulf, like for me, it's a bit complicated to answer the question because when I think that during my PhD, I was really like Gulf studies was really many people were like many white men working on political Islam and oil. And like when I was participating in a conference on Saudi Arabia, I was always in this last panel about society called Society, you know, and where we talk about migrants, women, and this kind of subjects. but it was not like, you know, the strategic panel on oil or the one on political Islam. And then I think in France, it's very small fields, so I kind of work more with people who are doing like post-colonial feminist sociology, who study gender and race and so on, but in other contexts. And I also work with some colleagues who work on the Gulf, but with other perspectives, but there are few people. So this is what I can say for the moment, I think.
I think one of the conversations that Ahmed and I had when we were first writing that conference paper was the different forms of legibility of expertise, right? That, you know, for me being of South Asian origin, I don't really register as a Middle East studies expert. So if you look at the places where my first book on Dubai circulates, it circulates more and is assigned more in South Asia studies, diaspora studies, migration studies courses versus Ahmed's book, right? And yes, some of that has to do with the fact that I'm focusing on immigration, but then Ahmed is too. And we talk about how, you know, being Arab American versus South Asian American provides particular kinds of openings and also particular kinds of closings. And in terms of what it means to be an academic, what it means to be a Middle East studies scholar, how do we circulate in conference settings, in job talks, in you know, in a lot of different spaces of academia.
Hello, can you hear me? Sorry, I hit the wrong unmute button. Sorry about that. Well, that echo is pretty hellacious. No, I think both, Emily and Neha, what they're saying is spot on. From my perspective, I mean, I saw exactly what Neha was referring to, which is the way in which at least the U.S. American Academy, you know, structures its expertise and regionalizes it in very, very sort of rigid ways. So she's absolutely right that my work is, you know, our books are really overlapping with each other. Our work shares so much, and yet the ways in which they are received by our colleagues they're received by almost two distinct audiences. So, you know, I don't know if that's necessarily a bad or good thing. I think that's just the reality that we're trying to sort of analyze and look at. In terms of my own work, I mean, I think that even beyond Middle East studies, my early work on Dubai was someone in Middle East studies called it, that said it was suffering from an edifice complex. That is, it was about buildings and urban spaces more than people. And, you know, because if you study like the Middle East, you have to study like people going to mosques and people like eating, I don't know, hummus or whatever. So my own first book, especially, and still this happens to me all the time, is really read by urbanists, architects, and design schools, which is okay. You know, I don't mind that. I've gotten some of my best and nicest feedback from you know, design and architecture students and professors in the region, in the Gulf. So I think that there are certain Neha is saying is definitely true about the structures of perception of these texts and of our work, of our expertise. I'll stop there.
Thank you very much for sharing these experiences with us. Lastly, echoing your book, I want to end on a note of hope and possibility with regards to academia. And so what are some of the decolonializing possibilities that we can work towards?
Thinking about being an academic has been co-writing. And this experience was just like, fabulous, like my best academic experience of like, it didn't even feel like work, quite honestly. Like, I don't know how this book materialized. It's like, I had fun doing it. And you know, we're in three different time zones, like, and I feel like collaborative work and not having these kinds of like, you know, diva ego complexes and you know, valuing people for their contribution rather than like the name of the university on their like badge at the conference or whether they have gotten their degree yet or not, I think is one place where I feel I can make a contribution, especially, but of course that contribution requires the kinds of problematic things that we're bringing up, right? It's because I'm post-tenure. It's because, you know, I work in a liberal arts context where you're allowed to kind of experiment with the scholarship that you do, that I can do this project and have it, you know, circulate. Like, I mean, let's be real. This book is circulating the way it's circulating because the three of us have established ourselves in particular kinds of ways. If it was three graduate students, it wouldn't have the same cachet, right? So for me, it's also about, I've been co-writing with a graduate student at University of Wisconsin, and I find that to be such a great learning opportunity for me. So these were some of the things that we were thinking about when we were writing both the introduction and the conclusion of the book. Like, how do we highlight, how do we utilize our position of power in the academy, however limited it is, you know, and we do talk about that, to highlight the kinds of projects and voices that aren't getting enough attention. So people from the region, graduate students, people who are not necessarily considered your typical experts in the field.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Ahmed, Amelie, and Neha, for joining us and sharing your insights. My name is Aliza Erjan. This discussion of Beyond Exception, New Interpretations of the Arabian Peninsula, published by the Cornell University Press in 2020, is brought to you by the New Books Network in association with the Mobilities and Methods Lab at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Thank you for listening.